ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hi, this is Mike Behe, Senior Fellow with Discovery Institute. In 1996, I kicked over the hornet's nest with my book, Darwin's Black Box, and Discovery Institute has been there for me ever since. They've been there for a lot of us, and you make that possible by your financial support for Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery Institute needs your help now more than ever. Please consider giving a donation today to support the Scholars of Intelligent Design. To give, go to discovery.org/CSC2021. That's discovery.org/CSC2021. Thanks very much.
Today's ID the Future is part two in a fascinating conversation between the world-renowned synthetic organic chemist and inventor James Tour and Brian Miller. Miller is an expert on thermodynamics as they relate to the origin of life, and he's research coordinator for Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Dr. Tour is speaking as we begin.
And this is what the chemist is faced with. We who do chemistry, who build molecules for a living, hear these origin of life arguments, and they make no sense to us because they say selectors, but generally the selector is more complex than the thing you're trying to make. How did you make the selector? And what gave that selector the ability to select out what you wanted to do? Without having these error correction in biology, biology dies very, very quickly because there are errors that take place. Even though in biological systems, the yields can be quite high, without having enzymes that fix it, this doesn't happen. You don't have those yet. You don't have those in origin of life. So it's a very, very hard argument. What I see is that I see that people throw out very simplistic ideas and they say selection takes care of it. You know, most researchers who actually do synthesis within origin of life, they don't willy-nilly throw out that term because they know people are going to call them on it. Where is the selector? But what's done is a very tricky little thing, is they'll do a reaction and they'll get, say, 10 different products. And the difference between what they want and some of those products is very, very small. And they separate, and they each one of these products is a peak. So they'll get 10 peaks in a very sensitive instrument called an HPLC. And they'll say, see, it is there. It's there. Now they go on to the next step, but they don't use the little blip that's there because it's too hard to separate. They'll buy that little blip or they'll make it using a natural method, and then they'll carry it on because they know they can't take that impure material and carry it on. Yet they throw that at the doorstep of nature, saying somehow nature figured out how to separate this thing. It must have been a crystallization or something. Well, if it's that easy, why don't you do it? And it's not just one step, it's step after step after step, such that the chemist becomes the selector. The chemist has said, that's the one I want. And then they've gone and they haven't even taken that out. They bought that entity. And then they've carried it on in the next step, get 10 more things. They see the one that they want. They said, see, we've done it. And then they buy the next one because that is an utter mess. Chemistry is a mess. And wouldn't you say it's hard to do chemistry when you can't remove the impurities?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. And here's what's really interesting is if you go back to the thesis that for cells to function and for biochemistry to move forward, you have to have engines, machinery that produces energy, and information to direct that energy in a way that's useful, the energy and the mass. Guess what happens in all these experiments? It affirms that thesis, because what happens is when you take a chemical and you make it highly concentrated and very pure, you're increasing its free energy. So while a cell has like ATP synthase, you've got a chemical factory that puts in the energy needed to produce this highly pure and purified chemical. Also, if you look at the sophisticated chemical protocols, the lab protocols, where they change conditions, they change reactants, they change pH, and et cetera, the information in the instructions is what constrains the outcome. So information will always, if it's used properly, constrain outcomes. It selects certain outcomes and remove others. In the case of an enzyme, it's the information in the sequence of the amino acids. In the case of a laboratory experiment, it's the information in the lab protocols that sets the conditions to get the results you want. So all these origin of life research, no matter what you're doing, demonstrates the need for engines or energy converters to supply energy, such as concentrating a chemical, and information to direct your outcomes.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's a huge amount of chemical input from the investigator himself or herself doing the very reaction. So to even think that this could happen without this input is unrealistic, because what I do is I go back and I read the experimental protocols and I read the supplemental experimental protocols, and it is filled with adjustments of pH, adjustments of concentrations, and you have concentrations and adjustments, and you shine a light at this time for this many minutes, then you turn off the light, and every one of those is information being input into the system.
Exactly. And even I showed you that one paper, at even a deep theoretical level, the most savvy origin of life researchers are realizing that information is something beyond mass and energy. Like, a great examples are Sarah Walker and Paul Davies, who are just great researchers. And they talk about in their paper, The Hard Problem of Life, that physics and chemistry will not produce a cell. That we have to think beyond that, and we have to talk about, and they talk about the causal power of information, as if information existed and it has a certain power over matter and energy. And of course, from my theological background, I would say that's an intelligent designer. That's God at work in the world, producing empirical results. So even though they're not religious and they won't go there, they still recognize that information is something beyond matter and energy, which is needed for life to work.
So take that for me a little bit further. What is the positive energy, the positive evidence for design in biology? What's the positive evidence for design?
Now, first of all, let's do a thought experiment to really appreciate the answer to that question. Because one of the challenges people face when they address this issue of design in biology is they ask, is there a scientific method to detect design? And the question should be looked at a little bit differently, because the study of biology or the origin of life, either way you want to look at it, is really under the field of engineering, because you're dealing with an engineered artifact produced by an intelligence far, far greater than ourself. So biology is essentially reverse engineering a technology far beyond ourself. So let's do a thought experiment. Imagine that you find a spaceship somewhere in Area 51. And two groups of scientists come together, and one, for whatever reason, refuses to believe in aliens. For whatever reason, they just philosophically can't consider that possibility. So they assume that the spaceship is simply a product of natural processes. While another group believes in the possibility of aliens, and they think, you know, we think the spaceship was engineered by an intelligence. How would they go about studying that spaceship differently, do you think?
Well, they have two very different starting points.
Right. And how does it affect the way they look at the spaceship, the sort of questions they'd ask, the sort of ways they would probe it?
Well, one person has to only appeal to a natural process. And the other person can look at this from outside that and say there are other processes that may be acting that we don't know about.
Yeah, very good. So what happened is the first group that didn't believe in aliens would say, well, this was probably produced by natural processes. So they would look at maybe volcanoes would produce molten metal that would flow into rock crevices to produce spaceship parts. And then maybe tornadoes or earthquakes would cause those parts to come together and assemble in the right way to produce a spaceship. How far do you think they would get with that research project?
It'd be kind of hard to ever show that to work.
Yeah, it's kind of like origin of life. Now, the second group that believes in design would say, we think this is engineered. So we're going to look for the purpose behind the parts. We're going to look for design patterns in this spaceship that match design patterns that we actually do. So if you look at the people that make progress in biology, it's the same thing. If you look at all this origin of life research, it's pretty much not gone any places you talked about. But what's happened is there's been this shift in the study of biology, particularly in the field of what's called systems biology. Because what's happened before is if you assume life is simply the product of blind chance and time and natural processes and natural selection and horizontal gene transfer, whatever, then there's certain assumptions you have about life. One is you'll assume that nothing in life has a real purpose. Any appearance of purpose is an illusion. It's just sort of an artifact of natural selection. They would typically assume that what you see is suboptimal in design. It may work, but it's probably not as good as it could be if it was designed by an intelligence. If you look up something like the argument from poor design, if you read Stephen Jay Gould's description of the panda's thumb or Nathan Lentz's book about human errors, you get that idea. They talk about this, how evolution predicts suboptimal, clumsy, poor design. They'd also predict it would have very little resemblance to human engineering. Now, why is that? Because if you envision that a blind, undirected search, perhaps with natural selection, could stumble across some solution to like locomotion or energy production, you have to assume in this vast search space, there's lots and lots and lots of ways for you to solve these problems if you're going to stumble across any of them. So you would never expect to randomly nature to stumble across something that looks like human engineering. That would be extremely rare. What's happened is in systems biology, people have found that all of the assumptions of scientific materialism, which is the idea that only matter and energy exist, everything's a product of natural processes, the assumptions of evolution have proven to be false. And what they've had to do to advance in biology is replace them with design-based assumptions, language, and tools and methods. And for that, I'm going to go back to, I'm going to go share my PowerPoint slide. And here, just to kind of make my point, this is a chapter in a book by David Hanke. He says, biology is sick. Fundamentally unscientific modes of thought are increasingly accepted and dominate the way the subject is explained to the next generation. The heart of the problem is that we persist in making literal sense of the world that we know to be senseless. And the whole point of his article, the teleology, the explanation that bedevils biology, and teleology just means design, is David Hanke's complaining that biologists talk about artifacts in life as if they were designed. He says that's wrong. Thinking that something's designed in life will lead you in the wrong direction. That's the whole point of his essay. But this book is really a wonderful book. It's System Modeling in Cellular Biology. It was put out by MIT. This was out 15 years ago, and I really think this was the start of this great revolution in systems biology. And here's a great quote from the book. A hope for understanding complexity in biology, then organized, is to uncover operational principles through a, quote, calculus of purpose by asking teleological questions such as why cellular networks are observed given their known or assumed function. So again, scientific materialism says there shouldn't be a purpose, and that's misleading. But we now know that if you look at the purpose of biological structures, that's what's going to lead you to their understanding. And again, I talked about how evolution assumes that things are suboptimal, but let me read you this. From engineering, it is known that feedback control plus feed-forward control enabled by fast and, if possible, remote advanced warning sensing is the most powerful mechanism for providing robustness to fluctuations in the environment and the component parts. The heat shock response in E. coli appears to employ exactly the same principles. So what you see consistently is what people used to think was poor design, like the panda's thumb, as science advances, they see as optimal design, as extraordinary design. So what's happening is if you look at researchers like Balick from Princeton, they're realizing if they assume that life is optimally designed, that leads to correct predictions. And what they're finding is that many life processes, like photoreceptors in eyes, operate at what is close to the theoretical highest efficiency that's possible by the biology. Here's another example. And this is really a great point, because people will say that biology is different from human engineering in many ways, and it is. But let's see why that's significant. We adopted a high-level view of cellular systems by combining biology and engineering approaches. This perspective does not want to disguise large differences between the two types of systems. In fact, biology often shows a more remarkable design than technology. And then here's another example. An often noted reservation against this type of analogies between biological and engineered systems we brought forward states that these two types of complex systems arise in fundamentally different ways, namely through evolution versus purpose-driven top-down design. So an evolutionary assumption is that you're not going to see purpose-driven top-down design. You'll have things that come together by chance, and maybe they'll form something useful coincidentally. But what has happened is these engineers who've looked at biology have realized that things in life look like they have a purpose, and it looks like top-down design, or that purpose led to the need for, let's say, components that have to be fit together perfectly to achieve that purpose, and all the components are needed. And then those components have subcomponents that have to be perfectly fit together to create the component, which then leads to the final product. So again, this is the exact opposite of what an evolutionary process should produce, is this top-down, high-efficient design that looks like human engineering. And this kind of leads into a beautiful set of lectures that Paul Nelson, one of my colleagues, has produced. And this will be available tomorrow. So if anyone viewing this looks up design triangulation as a path for biological inquiry, it's on Evolution News and Paul Nelson, you'll find this set of slides that he's using. And what he's talked about is how you can have a design-enabled biological research program using this top-down assumption. And the basic idea is that when we discover a complex system performing specialized functions, we assume that a rational logic, a well-matched parts, are enabling that functions. So in other words, when biologists look at some system they discover in life and they assume that it has a purpose, they can recognize that purpose requires certain components. And if some of the components haven't been found, they can predict that those are the components that will be found based on the purpose for which the system was created. Paul describes this as design triangulation. You have some black box, which is like a biological entity. You notice that there may be two components of a system that have been identified. You know for that system to work for its intended purpose, you have to have another component. And then the research is to look for that component. Now, Paul has a lot of examples, but I just want to talk about one particularly insightful one. And that's the discovery of the genetic code. Because Watson and Crick recognize that DNA has a structure and that it includes encoded information for proteins. And that would mean the amino acid sequence we talked about. And DNA has four letters, A, C, T, and G. And sets of three letters together form what's called a codon. And there are specific amino acids attached to specific codons. In some cases, it's one codon for one amino acid. Sometimes it can be much higher. And what happened is they recognized that if you look at the chemical nature of these nucleotides and of the amino acids, they don't really fit together because DNA carries information but is chemically non-specific. You just have these hydrogen bonds, but amino acids have specific geometries which require a system to recognize them. So the question becomes, how do you go from DNA, these three letter codons, to a particular amino acid? It can't happen through direct templating because they're not chemically connected. So what happened is Crick, because he decoded messages in World War II, is he proposed that there was an adapter molecule. And there were 20 adapters at least, and each adapter molecule would connect the codons with a specific amino acid. He also predicted that there were specific enzymes that would link these amino acids to these adapter molecules. And this was very much this design triangulation logic, looking at the top-down purpose of these decoding processes. And of course, people eventually found tRNA, the 20 tRNAs that relate to the different amino acids. And they found the aminoacyl enzymes, which linked the tRNAs to the amino acids exactly like Crick predicted. And what's really interesting is Watson did not like this adapter idea. He says, I do not like the idea at all. More to the point, the adapter mechanism seems to me too complicated to ever have evolved with the origin of life. And that's a key point. Because for this system to work, you've got to have a adapter, a tRNA, for every single amino acid. You also must have the enzymes which connect the amino acids to the tRNAs. And that all has to happen at once. If only one piece were missing, the translation would not work. You also, at the same time, have to have the protein sequences encoded into the DNA, and you have to have the machinery that will actually perform the translation process, that will start linking together amino acids based on the DNA code. And of course, that's a ribosome. So what happened, it was Crick's design intuition that led to an understanding of biology, but Watson, because he was trapped in the framework of scientific materialism, he did not believe in design. It was difficult for him to believe because the difficulty of it coming together. Now let's apply that to the origin of life. Because if you look at the origin of life from an intelligent design perspective, you recognize that life requires a lot of different pieces. It requires structure, metabolism, et cetera, et cetera. Now, here's what's super interesting, and this is the part that really excites me, is you have scientists or engineers or mathematicians like von Neumann that have asked the question, what is the simplest possible self-replicating machine you could produce? And people have applied this to robots. They've looked at this with, like, NASA has looked at what does it take to have a self-replicating space probe. And at the same time, what happened is biologists have been looking at what is the simplest possible cell that could exist. And for a cell simply to maintain itself out of equilibrium, the smallest you get is maybe 100 amino acids. And that's an incredibly optimistic list. It's almost certainly many times greater than that. But they've looked at the minimally complex self-replicating cell through a lot of various means. And what happens is when you look at the engineering analysis of the simplest components of self-replication, that design perspective allows you to predict an incredibly large number of components that must be in a cell. And what happens is a cell based both on the engineering analysis and on studies of the minimally complex genome means that the simplest possible cell has to have energy production, selective gateways that allow certain things in and certain things out, active transport to force things in against the natural thermodynamic tendencies, information processing, manufacturing, auto assembly, automated repair, sensor signal processing with algorithmic control, actuators that carry out instructions, control systems, and global coordination. This must be in anything that even resembles a cell, because if you don't have all these components, the cell breaks down and decomposes back into simple chemicals. So an intelligent design framework allows you to predict the components that you'll find in a cell. Now, even beyond that, because engineers have enormous experience with things like negative feedback loops, control systems, they can predict in advance what will be in a cell. Not the details, but the functional components. Now, here's a wonderful paper. It's called A Survey of Engineering Models for Systems Biology. And what they did is they came to this conclusion. It says, as a discipline, systems biology shares many characteristics with engineering. In this paper, we identify the cell as an embedded computing system, and as such demonstrate that systems biology shares many aspects in common with computer systems engineering, electrical engineering, and chemical engineering. And what they do is they go through and they say, we know that what they describe as embedded computing system needs digital logic. Here's what those components look like in a computer, and we can identify the components in a cell which carry out the function of digital logic. You need a microarchitecture, as you see in a cell. You need information system architecture with several subcomponents. We can find and predict what those components will be in a cell, not the details, but what they're doing, and then you can see what the actual chemistry is that does it. And you need an operating system. So again, what happens is when you look at life from a design framework, you can actually make progress because you can ask the question, what do these systems do? And from an engineering perspective, you can anticipate what those systems must contain in terms of their functional relationships. And then you can go look for those structures that perform those functions. And very often that leads to productive research. Again, if you believe in a blind, undirected process, you assume that it's going to be clumsy, suboptimal. If you believe in design, you believe it's going to be optimal, and time again, that prediction is proven true. Now, that's just, you know, touching the surface, but that's maybe a good start for the conversation.
That's just terrific. That is just terrific. I mean, you started out talking about the terms that are used, and they're all biological in origin, which just always mystified me as a synthetic chemist. We never spoke of molecular evolution. We never spoke of selection. I mean, we just had to make molecules. This has been co-opted from biology and brought in. And so it speaks of, now you're introducing life into non-life to try to get it to go. And then, you know, what I've always found fascinating, many people don't follow me on this, maybe you will, is that when we build robots, when people build robots, you never see us using biology to build the robot. We use silicon, we use composites, we use aluminum, we use wires, we use printed circuit boards. We don't use biology. Why don't we? Because we don't understand how to get this stuff to work together. And we don't use biological components to make our robots, although if we could, they'd look a lot more human-like, they'd look a lot more biology-like, but we don't, because it's so hard for us to understand those systems. And you know, that's what we're up against.
That was part two of our three-part ID the Future series on the origin of life problem, with James Tour as host and guest Brian Miller. Thanks goes out to Tour for permission to borrow the interview, which originally aired on his show, The Science and Faith Podcast. For ID the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.